Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999. I'm your host, Phil Isco. And with us today is Alex Amin and Haley Wirango. Alex is a talent agent at UTA. Haley is a film and TV producer. We're going to be talking about an episode whose title I will absolutely butcher because I don't know French. Do you guys know French? Can you?
I do.
Can you say it for us?
Sure. Well, we're also friends. That's what you missed from our introduction.
I mean, obviously, we're friends.
The title is La Douleur Exquise.
Perfect. Fantastic. Mm-hmm. This is episode 212 of season 2. But before we get to this episode, I want to talk about how Carrie and Co. came into your lives. Did you guys watch this show in 99? And if not, when did you watch it? And did it have a formative effect on you as young women?
Alex?
It was like bootleg. In 99, I was a freshman in high school, and I did not have HBO because it was expensive, but one of my friends did, and one might argue that I was friends with her because she had HBO. she would record it on a VHS and bring it. She would maybe record a couple episodes on one VHS. So I would get like two or three or four episodes. And like once a month, she would give me a VHS and I would go home, watch it, and then bring it back to her. And she would re-record the next few on, you know. So I did watch it in real time, but missed the first season because of that. It wasn't until the second season that I started watching. And then after the show, or maybe somewhere before the last few episodes, or last few seasons, I went back and caught up on anything that I had missed.
So it was sort of like contraband for you, is what you're saying.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Haley, what about you?
In 99, no. In 99, I was in eighth grade and living in Chicago, and we did not have HBO. Because it was expensive, and I don't know, we didn't. But 2 years later, in 2001, we moved to Michigan, and one of the many, many sort of sweeten the deal effects of moving from Chicago to a smaller town in Michigan one of which was getting a dog, and the other which was that we suddenly had all the channels, which was not something that was actually like presented to us as a perk.
Sure, but sure.
It's what happened? That's when I started watching it. So like Alex, I think I missed the first year or two, but then would also see reruns on HBO. So, kind of got caught up.
But you're both sort of close to the same age mm-hmm. when it comes into your life to a certain degree, mm-hmm. it feels like. And I mean, I posited this question to other guests, but I'm obviously very interested to hear about your experiences. Did you feel like it shaped your dating experiences or the way that you sort of went into, like the way you thought of men, quite frankly? Because this show was groundbreaking in many ways. And one of them being obviously that it was empowering to women and that it was from their perspective, and that the men were, I don't want to say disposable, but they were a little disposable in the first couple seasons. I mean, until these relationships started to really take root in the characters, it felt that way. Did that in any way sort of change your perception of men or how you went into, you know, dating?
I would say maybe less men and more like, yeah, the idea of sex, adult relationships and dating, or like what a version of that, albeit like filtered through like Hollywood or whatever, might look like.
Sure.
And I think in a way there was a really great thing about making things, it's just like normalizing and sort of like
mystifying.
And taking the taboo away from that stuff, especially like I went to a Catholic school when we lived in Chicago. So, you know, it just like, it just kind of blew the door open on all of that stuff.
Well, I also feel like, there's the Friends effect too, right? I mean, Friends is in its heyday at this moment. So you really have two drastically dissimilar. First of all, one is actually in New York, and the other is the Warner Brothers soundstages in Burbank. And I think that, you know, in so many ways kind of crystallizes how these two shows, you know, one was a fantasy, one was, you know, they're living in this giant apartment in New York City, and you know, it's this is very idyllic perspective of they're younger as well. It should be said that the characters on Friends are supposed to be younger than the characters on Sex and the City. So I understand there's a maturity difference, but I just mean sort of, you know, I was never a teenage girl. I was never a woman in my 20s. I never sort of obviously saw things through that lens. And I'm just sort of wondering how these two shows, or how just television in general and how Sex and City fit into that. Alex, did it change sort of the way that you, I mean, we talked a little bit about this on Felicity too.
Right.
You know what I mean? In terms of like the college experience too.
I'm going to reference going back to the episode that we talked about Felicity, where, you know, television was my foray into, the obsession with living in New York, which I did end up then going to NYU sure. for college. And, you know, it's funny that you say Friends sort of being the fantasy version of New York, because Sex and the City is such a fantasy.
Totally. You know, they are
so rich. They're so thin. Their hair is perfect all the time. The clothes, their apartments. I'm like, Carrie's apartment is incredible, you know, even if it's small, it's incredible. Mm-hmm. They're going out to dinner all the time, all the time. I'm like, how do you afford this life? And that's what I, you know, in terms of like informing my perception of dating and adult relationships and living in New York, which was, you know, as a teenager in the Valley in 1999, you know, adulthood and sexual liberation and maturity also was synonymous with like living in New York. That just was like, mm-hmm. that was it. It all, you know, that was the pinnacle. That was what you wanted to strive for. It was like, well, I want to live in New York. If that me, and I want to be as cool as these ladies, and I want to have like, you know, obviously we hadn't dated really yet. Dating wasn't right. really a thing. I think there were touch points where, you know, at that point, I think we all probably had experienced crushes and heartbreak. So you felt like, you felt like their stories were soon to be yours. You know, you were excited to get to that point where you would be experiencing that.
In a way, being a teenager is sort of like, I mean, being a teenager makes you so impressionable on like all sorts of fronts. But I think in terms of timing, like it just, yeah, it, that, that aspirational quality like is so huge with this show. And, you know, I feel like if I was like, you know, 10 years older, I'd be sort of embarrassed to be like, well, am I a Carrie or am I a Samantha, you know? But like, not when I was, you know, 18, like, or 16.
Sure.
It's so funny that you talk about Sex and the City and Friends. I mean, rightly so, because they were on at the same time. But like, Friends to me is not a New York show at all. Friends could be set literally anywhere. Like, there's just like nothing about the show or any of the characters to me that like feels specific.
Scream New York. Yeah.
And I didn't really watch Friends. I was aware of it, but it just wasn't something that was a thing for me when it was on air.
You know what's funny? There's two things that I wanted to bring up. The first is I caught, I don't know, 15 minutes of a Seinfeld episode the other day. Mm-hmm. And the fact that that feels like a New York show, even though it was shot here, and Friends doesn't, and I don't even mean the neurotic Jewish sensibility of Seinfeld, which obviously is akin to New York to some degree or another, but even just the aesthetics of it feel more the like New York.
On the streets, the exhaust, the people, the colors, the size of the apartment, even, you know, I mean, bigger than like.
Their clothes too. Like there's like a lived in component to Seinfeld that Friends, quite frankly, didn't strive for. And this isn't a knock on Friends. I think they were going for something different. Sure. But to your point, it doesn't feel like a New York show. The other thing that I wanted to, I just watched the first episode of the Scorsese Fran Lebowitz Netflix thing.
Yeah.
Which is fantastic.
The first episode. Yeah.
It's fantastic. But the one of the things that, I mean, she says there's so many gems that she says just in the first episode. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that I loved was when she said that someone came to her and was like, I really want to move to New York, but I just can't afford it. And she's like, none of us can afford it. No one can afford it. But somehow everybody lives in New York and they figure it out. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's part of that wish fulfillment thing. That's part of that like fantasy of the person that can hack it, the person that can like make it work.
And it's also like a willful, like it's willful irresponsibility. You know what I mean? You know, you could save money. More money elsewhere. You know, you could double your square footage like elsewhere, but it's like, nope, like we're doing this, you know? Mm-hmm. And while there is like a sort of like slight myth making of it being all worth it, because I too lived in New York for a short period of time when I was younger, like it's true. it's not like, like there's a part of it is something that you do buy into, but it's also like, it's also true.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's also something, I mean, and specifically to Sex and the City, you know, rewatching the show, first of all, I mean, if I'm being completely honest, I don't watch the second season that much. Generally speaking, when I rewatch the show, it's from 3 on, because I think that the first season is very strange. There's a lot of talking to the camera. There's a lot of like weirdness going on.
The first season.
I feel like it's fun to watch the first
season. Get us to the second season.
I feel like the first season is fun to watch to because of that contrast and to like see how far we've come.
Season 2 feels like it's getting its sea legs though.
Charming slightly, you know. There is something charming about it. And but season 2 is the sort of like transitional period, which it does. I mean, it doesn't feel like it doesn't know what it is. You know, it's not right. That. It's just that it probably doesn't really hit its stride until.
Yeah, I mean, I you know, I've said this on previous episodes, so you know, forgive our listeners for me repeating myself, but I do think that you know, there's the Darren Star, Michael Patrick King component of this show of two very different voices, both very talented.
Episode.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. We will get there. There's a lot of the thing is, and I don't mean to sound like I'm denigrating Darren Star, because I do think that Darren Star, first of all, is enormously successful. So, you know, give him props for that. But also, he's making fun shows that people really love. I think people love Younger. People really love Emily in Paris. Mm-hmm. I watched the whole thing. Whether or not I liked it or not is, you know, debatable, but I watched the whole thing. He has a very specific voice that borders on too broad for me personally. And we certainly feel that in this episode at times. So it's once Michael Patrick King completely takes the reins of the show, which is essentially during season three, when the depth of the show starts to show and you start to really feel these characters starting to show just more range, more complexity than they did in the earlier seasons. And I would say this season, and I've been loving doing these deep dives each week because I think there's a lot more to this show than people give credence to. I think that it's a very easy show to dismiss based on its aesthetics, based like on
most
like
things that were wildly successful. It's very easy to be like, huh, it's not that great. The show is great. Like the show was doing, you know, a lot. And it's always like that thing where it's like that testament to progress or the way we've moved forward when certain things just feel like dated. But that's what happens when you're sort of on the front edge of things in the moment, I think. It's not a perfect show. It's definitely coming from a very specific point of view. And there are not, you know, but it's real good.
I think it's also, I just did a full rewatch of Girls just recently.
That's the other show that people just love to be like, well, you know, it's like, fuck off. Like,
especially in the beginning, because I was tweeting about it a little bit and some people, you know, some people responded. And I'm not going to sit here and say that both of these shows don't suffer from significant diversity issues.
Of course.
I mean, both of these shows live in. Yeah.
What was that, Alex?
Well, anything up until a couple years ago did.
Truly.
Yeah, sure, but it's really crystallized in Sex and the City, in a way that dates it, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But watching Girls, you know, which was, some might argue, overrated in its first season and then woefully underrated for basically the entire remainder of the series. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's two things that are very similar about these shows, which is that men didn't get it, or men felt threatened by it, or men felt like there was some component of feeling like the shows were attacking them in some way, mm-hmm. which I don't think they were. I think they were being pretty honest, if I'm being truthful about. I mean, I think that Adam's character on Girls is one of the best male characters on television.
Yeah.
I mean, not just the performance, but
100% dated that character, that guy. I mean,
And that's the beauty of Sex and the City and the serial, like the serial dating thing and the, you know, anecdotal stories of each episode, mm-hmm. because we've all dated that guy, you know, quote unquote, we've all dated that guy or an element mm-hmm. of that guy or some guy we've dated.
Or tried to.
Yeah, right.
Just
speaking. And, you know, the male characters that return and we get for arcs, for character arcs, you know, I think that we all, that's sort of the beauty to me and the brilliance of the show is that it becomes flipped, you know, our lives as we evolved and grew up with the show. You then take pause sometimes in when you're in a relationship or getting out of a relationship and say, like, God, this is like, you know, not to be basic, but this sort of is like a Mr. Big moment, or this is, you know, am I dating Aiden and I want to be with Big or blah, 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 you know, like, and that's what makes a really successful show when you feel on like in the minutiae, you can be like, oh my God, that totally happened to me. Mm-hmm. And then as you get older and you go back and you rewatch the episodes and they all feel so, you know, you're like, God, I remember when that happened. Oh, like, oh man. And you know, I guess I have my series arc characters too. And like the brilliance of those characters and those male characters, because they're in large part, you know, those do feel like real men to me. I mean, you know, the things that they're struggling with, particularly Big, you know, somebody could write, I'm sure people have, but a thesis on Mr. Big and who that character.
Oh, I'm sure there are many, many, many pieces about it. I'll say one thing though, that I wanted to piggyback on what you were saying there about using television shows as litmus tests, as mirrors to what's going on in your own life. First of all, I don't think that's basic. I think that that's what a television show should do. I mean, good TV makes you reevaluate the type of person that you are or see yourself on screen, which is why diversity is so unbelievably important, which is you need to be able to see yourself there and be able to kind of, you know, take a second and be able to reevaluate what's going on in your life. And, you know, it's funny you say, you know, as you watch these shows, rewatch these shows through different lens at a different point in your life, they change the way that you perceive them. You know, I used to think that Big was kind of like cool and fun, I guess. And he still has those moments. But now watching him, just like, this guy fucking sucks, man. Like, he's just selfish. And I think that, I understand the idea, and it's been thrown at me on many occasions of like, TV isn't reality, but it is a mirror of reality. And I think that there is some legitimacy to you know, using that as a,
it's funny,
you know, a way to see your own.
It's funny you say that, because I was watching this episode last night and a couple leading up to it with my partner, and he was saying, God, I used to think Big, when I watched the show when I was younger, I looked up to Big. I thought he was dope, but maybe it's just because he was a rich guy. But Big sucks. And in particular, and I think that's what makes this episode one of the more profound ones, because a pivotal thing happens between Carrie and Big that really, you know, is the pattern of Carrie and Big. But that scene, or, you know, the few of them, when, you know, he says, and I'm sure that we'll recap.
Oh, we will, yeah.
But, you know, those fights felt real to me. And him showing up at 2:30 in the morning because he knew he was being a fucking asshole felt real. You know, that's those fights, they felt very – that felt like you were in the writer's room with them. You
know? Totally. Well, and speaking to what you were saying before, Phil, about like the show itself hitting its stride, I had listened to the episode with Amy B. Harris, and I feel like the stuff that she was saying about, you know, the writers and whatnot bringing their own stories to the writer's room, there had to have been like just like a, you know, exponential sort of like, the positive feedback that the show was garnering, you know, must have galvanized them, you know, a bit and helped them sort of find that stride. And I do think that's like where so much of the great stuff of the show is, because the specificity is everything.
I think the show also does a tremendous job of, I mean, it was mocked for its puns. And for its perhaps its lack of subtlety at times, but you know, I really appreciated the idea anyway, even if they hammer it a little hard, and we'll talk about it. But the idea of Carrie realizing that she's in an abusive relationship, that she's, you know, that she's taking an emotional beating from this person, and continues to go back for more. And what pleasure does she get from the pain of this relationship? I think is very insightful and smart. And you know, I don't know. I think that they perhaps go a little far with the S&M stuff.
Yes.
I'm gonna give a.
it's a you know, it's a really insightful and smart read of like relationships and the human condition and sex. A woefully like it's not what S&M is.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm going to give a brief synopsis for those who haven't seen the episode. Carrie is horrified when Big casually tells her he's moving to Paris for 7 months. Miranda dates a man who only has sex in places where he might get caught. Charlotte meets Buster, a high-end shoe salesman with a serious foot fetish. And Samantha introduces the girls to a hot new S&M restaurant. Samantha, by the way, has no storyline in this episode. No. Which is very strange.
Yeah, right. I was looking at my notes and I was like,
Because Samantha takes the fourth.
That's right, he does. Yeah. But we did, which is great.
It is interesting, and I noted that the episode devoted to kink, mm-hmm. Samantha's not in it,
which is strange.
And I think it comes right after or right before, because like you, Alex, I watched a few of them like mm-hmm. around the episode that mm-hmm. Samantha, like her old flame, the Warren Beatty look.
That's the previous one, yeah.
Yeah. And that is like, she's totally trying to like do some mm-hmm. sort of power dynamic with him and, mm-hmm. you know, fails. But
yeah, that was, I noted that as well in the previous episode, which is that they kind of leave money on the table, if you ask me, which is like you have this seismic relationship from Samantha, a person who we believe to be quite sort of unattached and unencumbered with emotions. And it's done in a hammy sort of way. The actor they bring on kind of sucks, quite frankly. Like, he's not really very good. And they just kind of like ditch it. And then they don't even give her a follow-up. Like, you would think that the next episode would at least sort of dig a little bit into that, and in fact they just give her no storyline at all, which is strange. The interesting
thing is like where I, you know, at its like, at a very basic level, like S&M is about sort of power dynamics. Like this episode is actually about kink, right? Or is supposed to be about like all these different, and it's all mm-hmm. rolled into one. And it's not really about, I guess, with the exception of Carrie and Big, it's not really about power at all.
Right.
Yeah.
So this episode aired on August 22nd, 1999. It was written by Ali Levi and Michael Patrick King and directed by Allison Anders. This episode landed at number 85 on the Vulture ranking. Basically, they didn't really have very much to say that it was particularly good about it. But the episode is named after the restaurant, which Haley was kind enough to pronounce earlier, which translates to the exquisite pain, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. The theme of the episode very much is about fetishes, letting your freak flag fly, which I very much appreciate. I like that the show often, I don't want to say too often, but like goes to that well a little bit. There's a freak show episode earlier in this season as well, literally called Freak Show, with the one with where she dates the guy who has a Tweety Bird tattoo, and she freaks out and thinks that it's a good episode. Mm-hmm. But I guess there is an overarching kind of all encompassing idea to this show, which is you have nothing to be ashamed of. Be who you are. Sex is funny. Sex is weird. Sex is complicated, but there is nothing wrong with it. And I think that taking those taboos and kind of breaking those ceilings really can be seen. I did an episode with Emily Nussbaum at the beginning of the series where we talked about her New Yorker article, and she talked about how that first scene, or one of those first scenes of the four of them in the back of the cab in season one, when they're talking about anal sex. Mm-hmm. And she was just like, it was just kind of like a kind of blow your mind moment that a show was willing to go to that place. It was willing to talk about these things, have fun with these things. I think it's incredibly important. And I think this episode runs with that, even if it does open with this weird restaurant, S&M restaurant. I mean, I don't know about you, but like, I don't really like my food mixed with my sex. So I'm just not sure why that happened.
What you need to know about an S&M restaurant is that it's a medieval banquet hall. And there's a lot of bread. The first thing is a pile of bread, which we all know does not mix with tight leather.
It just makes you feel bloated.
There's like big hunks of meat, and it's it's got like a real fiefdom.
Like, Game of Thronesy kind of vibe to it, quite frankly. Yeah, Carrie has a great line where she says, this is what happens when your mayor shuts down all the sex shops. It shows up in your cuisine, which is a great shot at Giuliani.
Yeah. Oh gosh. Wow.
You also have a great moment where Samantha tells Charlotte that the invitation said kinky, and Charlotte's like, I kinked my hair. I mean, it's it's a fun way to open the episode, and I'm thankful that they kind of drop the sort of absurdity of S&M. Like, we don't see any more like leather clad ball gags and such. It's just sort of like, you know, they move past that. So Carrie goes to Biggs and shows up with a riding crop and a top hat.
Wait. Can we back up?
Yeah, please. Yeah.
Because first, in the scene at the table where Samantha's sitting, over her shoulder the entire time is a woman who's fully naked, waist up, and she's just looking straight at the camera. She's just in the far background, and she doesn't even move. Maybe it's a mannequin, but I don't think so.
That's amazing.
That's the kind of boundary pushing you can expect from HBO. And I did just think that Sex and the City is back, you guys. I just got a little
It's back. Okay. So this is actually a good time to ask this question. No, please. I don't give a shit. I feel like doing the show, a limited sort of however many episodes, without Samantha, because it's pretty clear that Kim Cattrall is not joining the crew again.
Yeah.
Feels unfortunate. Mm-hmm. That being said, I would much rather them find a better way to resolve this than with the horrible Sex and the City 2, which was one of the worst movies I've ever seen. So I guess it's kind of, we'll just have to see how it shakes out. I mean, the room has started, apparently. It's starting in a couple weeks.
No, I think this week.
Sorry?
I think it starts this week. Mm-hmm.
And like, a lot of the old writers are back, which is great.
That's amazing.
You know, and I'm excited to see what this show looks like in 2021. Yeah. I think that they've got a steep hill to climb a little bit, but I'm curious. And
the big question is like, what's it going to be about?
Like, yeah, I know.
It's going to be, are Harry and Big still together? Is everyone still really rich? Like, what, where do you go from there? I mean, I don't know. I'm sort of like, let it die. I mean, it was so good. And without Samantha, thank God Samantha is not coming back, or Kim Cattrall, because like, let the poor woman just have, she was a masterpiece.
Let her collect those residuals and
And just let it lie as that, you know, but the woman, my God, she's 65 years old. Like, don't do her wrong like that. Don't make her come back and be Samantha Jones now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it was Dana Schwartz on a previous episode pitched an idea of, there's a version of Sex and the City where they're in like their 70s or something, and like Samantha has died, and it's like perhaps some of their husbands have passed on, and it's more about like, what does sex and singledom look like in your 70s or 80s? I actually would be game to see that show. Like, that's an interesting, that feels like it's a new way in. My fear is, what does this look like? I don't know what this looks like. It's a very strange thing. But who am I kidding? I'm going to watch
it. I'm also curious. I am, especially in light of watching this episode, which is all about fetish and kink, where, you know, like in any Sex and the City episode, things happen that you're like, oh, that would never happen now. Whoa, oh my gosh. Like, Samantha with these people as they go into her club, and, you know, the underwear only club that Stanford ends up at, and a guy grabs his underwear, and you're just like, oh my God, this is just, these are lawsuits all over the place.
There's a real lack of consent in this episode.
Except Charlotte with the foot fetish guy. So true. He got her consent.
He did get her consent.
He's a gentleman.
Sure.
But she was a willing partner.
Participant, yeah.
So,
I mean, I think, like, yeah, sorry. Please.
Like, what do, how are they going to pushed the boundaries, which Sex and the City did in its time, which, as you referenced, like the anal, the anal sex conversation in the back of the cab.
Yep.
Like that
yep.
was, that was taboo then. And now, like, now that there have been so many things also that followed in Sex and the City's footsteps, like expunged upon those types of, you know, sexual discovery.
Yep.
Where do they go now and still maintain that kind of, you know, wow factor with the show? And, you know, and that was maybe part of the reason why the movies weren't as good as the show, because they had lost that a little bit, you know, as they got older.
Yeah. I mean, I'll say this. I think that the series itself kind of ended as good as you could expect it to. You know, there was a bit of an ellipse at the end. If you want to believe that her and Big made it work, you can have that fantasy. If you want to think that they still struggled and that they might not have made it, you have that too. It made it abundantly clear that the friendships were perhaps the most important thing. Mm-hmm. You know, they really did a good job. And I think that, that last string of episodes, that last six episodes, really plays like a movie. If you kind of put them all together in a way that's really effective. I don't want to even really acknowledge the films, if I'm being completely honest. And I don't say that in a sort of to negate them or to denigrate them necessarily. They're just not my thing. They feel like the show dialed up to like 100, and it's just not, it's just not what I go to the show for. I like the intimacy of the show. I like the small 22-minute components of it. I think that they do a really good job at that. The question that I'm asking myself, the reason why I'm hoping they're going back to the well and that it isn't just a cash grab and that they aren't just trying to make HBO Max happen, I just hope that it's because A, they have something to say, B, they want to get back to the things that I was just talking about in terms of trying to get back to that sort of intimate storytelling, that character-based storytelling. Mm-hmm. Let's hope that that's what it is. In terms of what the impetus of the show is and like what they're actually, like what stories they have to tell, your guess is as good as mine. But listen, I've got faith in these writers. They did it for a long time, and I'm excited to see what they continue to do with it. So, for what that's worth. But in terms of this episode,
yeah. Right?
Sorry?
Isn't Michael Patrick King going to direct also? Which, thank God. Great. Great, great, mm-hmm. great.
Yeah, there's a part of me that's very sort of, I'm kind of split about the films in a lot of ways because I understand the blank checkness of them. Like if I'm Michael Patrick King and Warner Brothers says, do whatever you want, I might go to Abu Dhabi. Like, I mean, I don't know. Like if there are no sort of like, so on some level, I don't necessarily condemn the bigness and the kind of, you know, audacity, quite frankly, of the movies. It's just not what I go to the show for. So that's just kind of, anyway. This episode, however, we are back to Carrie shows up at Big's apartment with a riding crop and a top hat, and in classic Big style, doesn't laugh because he's a dick and he likes to, for whatever reason, humiliate her whenever he gets the opportunity to do so.
Aloofness really goes a long way. A couple of notes here.
Please.
Big's shirt. Dear Lord. Ugh, awful. And then, so she's got the riding crop and the hat, and they start to make out against the wall, and he takes off one of her necklaces and throws it.
Yeah, what's that about?
I don't know. Like,
I noticed that too, because I thought he was going to undo the, yeah, she's wearing like a
halter.
Some sort of a top. Yeah, yeah, halter top.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, okay. But then he takes off her necklace.
Tosses
like,
all right. One of the necklaces. Okay, fine.
Yeah. So then we find out that Stanford is chatting online in sort of sex chat rooms.
Maybe it was kind of a de-shackling move because it was like, shackle release.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Maybe.
Sure.
Maybe? Yeah. Sorry.
I'll say this. If we made a drinking game in this episode with Carrie, whenever she says the word tied, ties, tying, anything, we would be hammered after about 5 minutes of this episode. They really, really hit that hard. So then Charlotte goes to a shoe store.
You know, back to Sanford.
Oh, sorry, Sanford. I'm trying to work through the storyline.
I know. But okay. He's doing some online dating once again. gay men pave the way for us all. Like, you know, it's like this is his sort of like kink corner, right? Like talking to dudes online. It's like couldn't be more normal. Now,
I first of all, 110% agree with you. What I thought was interesting though is I was trying to rewind in my brain to like what the internet kind of was in 99 and what this interaction would even fully be. Because like obviously there wasn't any video. So it's really just sort of, and I don't even think is it AIM at that point?
Yes.
Do we have that?
It would have been AIM. It looked the interface.
It had a little bit of that, right? Yeah. Okay. So I guess that's sort of what it's kind of just like, yeah, it's creepy sex chatting. He's going by the name Rick 9 Plus. Mm-hmm. So he has that. So then in the Charlotte storyline, she is going to a shoe store, feeding her fetish or her addiction, depending on how you want to look at it. Although, great sequence.
It's sort of retro, great music. I love
Do we feel like Charlotte is a shoe character, though? No. Right? Because I feel like
nice things.
I guess. It's just Carrie's all about the shoes, right, if I'm not mistaken. And I felt a little bit like this was, forgive the expression, but shoehorning in this idea of
she's
Charlotte
more
being
of
a shoe.
Waterford Crystal kind of. Late setting. I feel like when she and what's his butt were getting married.
Buster? Like, Trey.
Trey. Yeah. It was like all about the place settings, right? And the registry and stuff. Like that's her dish. But this is like them kind of really introducing the shoe, like shoes being such a thing. And guys, I adjusted for inflation. These shoes cost over $620. And this is like pre Jimmy Choo Manolo, you know, like taking over the world and sort of saying that like anyone in their right mind could spend so much money on shoes. At first I was really worried that this guy just was an employee and I was like, he's gonna get fired. Like,
I was gonna say, I kept thinking like, I'm like, Buster, what are you doing, man? Yeah, you're gonna get fired. Like it's crazy.
By 7 and it's like, it's not like she's an 11 and you know, you gotta move those.
Right.
You're on Madison Avenue. Like the next in 10 minutes, those are going to sell.
Mm-hmm. So can I ask, I have to ask a question, and I actually haven't asked this question before, and I don't really know how to word it, so forgive me. But so shoes and women are a thing that I don't completely understand. And I say that with all due respect. Is it the same thing as like boys and technology, for lack of a better way of putting it? Like,
boys and shoes?
So boys and sneakers is what you're saying.
I'm the boy.
So Erica Gillian and his sneakers is what you're saying.
I think that Sex and the City was the thing that
introduced the idea
that women were obsessed with shoes and willing to spend a year's salary on shoes over the course of a couple years. I mean, it does that. I don't know, but I think
there's also this thing that like shoes, like pending some like really unfortunate circumstances, like shoes always fit, you know?
Right. Okay. That was in a film. The one.
In her shoes?
In her shoes.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think
she finally lost 15 pounds and found real happiness.
Exactly.
Yeah.
God, what we do to women. But I think we all learned, I think like some sort of hegemonic, you know, absorption from watching the city that it was like, oh, shoes equals femininity, shoes equals, you know, maturity and beauty. And I guess that's what I need to do.
It's like a cross section of independence and like frivolity, you know, like it's like I got money to burn or I don't, but I'm doing it.
Yeah. Like I remember that episode when she realizes that she has spent like $400,000
I will. I'm literally going to be the woman that lives in her shoes.
Yes. That was a great episode. And I remember when that aired for the first time and I was like, thank you for acknowledging the absurdity of this shoe obsession. And the, you know, it's not realistic. You're a writer, you're a columnist, you're not a stockbroker.
I think first of all, you're completely right in the comparison to this, I don't want to say it's a fad, but the sneaker phenomenon that is happening, that has been happening for the past couple of years. You know, it's the shocking price tags on the things that people are willing to buy and put on their feet, which is completely fair. I guess my other question to you would be, you know, you guys are both sort of hitting on this idea of how sort of seismic the fashion was in this show, right? Like Patricia Fields and you know, the outfits that Carrie wears, as impractical as they might very well be, were huge. I mean, it was really sort of seismic change. Do you think that it sounds like you're saying that a lot of shoe brands and a lot of big sort of shoe designers kind of came through this show, it feels like, right?
Absolutely.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Like 100%. I think it told like it a huge swath of the population like would not have known what Manolo Blahnik was. Like,
right.
Why would you? Yeah, it was they should all still be writing Pat Field.
Sure.
Right? Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, so iconic. And like, what was her store? It was just her name, right? On Bowery.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I remember going there. I lived in New York in 2007. So like the show was long over, but like you still like went because she was so fucking cool. Yeah.
So, I mean,
Patricia Fields and the whole, you know, the whole costume design of the show turned Sarah Jessica Parker into a fashion icon.
100%.
I mean, yeah. She wasn't a fashion icon before this show, but still to this day, she still gets that Met Gala invite.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she does. So at this point, Buster is willing to give Charlotte 50% off of the shoes because her feet are cute. I don't really understand the logic, but that's what it is. Miranda meets Jack, played by Will Arnett.
At Arnett.
at a bookstore.
Pre-stardom Arnett.
Pre-everything. I mean, this is before he's on Sopranos, where he has a short arc on that. Mm-hmm. It's obviously pre-Arrested Development. I mean, he's just a guy.
Sorry.
Yeah. So she meets him at a bookstore. They talk about some fucking obscure autobiographies and biographies. Yeah, and
very specific historical titles.
Very specific.
Off the
tongue. I'm just going to hone in on this storyline for a second, specifically. Mm-hmm. So she meets Jack. They go on a date. He takes her to see where Mark Twain lived and wrote Huck Finn, and then proceeds to have sex with her in the alleyway in front of this house.
Yes.
Which is insane on many levels, but I mean, it's I think insane might be strong. It's strange, maybe.
Sure. Yes.
Sure. and it becomes clear that he's interested in having sex in places where they might get caught. Mm-hmm. He then proceeds to perform oral sex on her in a cab, which seems unbelievable and impractical, but perhaps
really disrespectful.
Anatomy. Like what? Like how is that supposed to work? Like I don't.
Yeah, so and also Miranda, pipe down. You went over.
Well, they're talking about. He's like, I'm gonna go down on you. I'm like, the cab driver is too happy.
Yeah, and then all he's like,
like what happened? Like, I know this is a TV show, but it is a visual medium. Like. You know,
we've all been in a New York cab. They're fucking gross. Like the idea of like doing this in a cab is just, I don't know.
Yeah.
It's not
that post-COVID, in a post-COVID world.
So this storyline, so then Miranda and Charlotte and Carrie go for a walk. Miranda talks about how she's never had sex with this guy in a bedroom. Mm-hmm. This storyline, forgive the climaxes with Miranda.
You can't help it.
I can't help it. Miranda having sex with Jack in his bedroom. Mm-hmm. Miranda hears something and says, I think someone's coming. He says, oh, it's my parents. They're staying with me. He then proceeds to climax while his parents are watching them.
Making eye contact with them.
Giving an insane face.
Yeah.
And Miranda is essentially being violated at this point, right? Like, there's no other word for this other than mm-hmm. you do not have consent to do what you're doing to this woman under these circumstances.
Yes.
I mean, wasn't her parents, thank God. Like, she can walk away from that situation, but...
Physically, maybe not emotionally, yeah, but sure. Yeah.
But you know what, though? That, like, okay, so, like, relatively, that last scene notwithstanding, like, the nonchalance that Miranda was talking about all the different places that
yes.
they had sex, and, like, Miranda's, yeah. like, this, you know, the serious one. She's the lawyer. She's, like, yep. She's not Samantha, right? She's probably... Mm-hmm. with Charlotte sort of on the other side of the spectrum in some ways. Yep. And I think that there is something that's just really nice about that destigmatization. Like,
yes.
you know, like I just, that's, it just is something that happens in stride, whether that's totally realistic, you know?
Right.
But,
it also brings up in that scene, we also have Charlotte saying, Carrie sees her shoes and is like, where the fuck did you get those? And Charlotte's like, oh, I let this guy touch my feet and he gave them to me.
Yeah. And then she's like, she knew what she had to do. She had to give him back. Why?
Yeah, why?
Like, and, what? And okay, if he was an employee and gonna like lose his job, or mm-hmm. like if she felt like there was something sort of like, I don't know, untoward or like non-consensual. I was sort of like, don't shame this guy. He gave you, you still paid at least $300 for them in today's money. Like,
not the second pair.
Well, the second pair were free. That's right.
Second pair were totally free. He just kind of held her feet. So then what happens is she goes back to Buster. She's like, I can't take these shoes. He looks at the bottom, says, these are worn. I can't take them back. She's like, well, I can't pay for them. He's like, okay, you can keep them as long as you let me put on a bunch of other shoes on your feet.
Yeah.
And we then proceed to have a whole sequence of Buster basically ejaculating while touching her feet in a series of very strange faces on both parts. Although, I mean, Kristen Davis does a great job of just being
sort of
not understanding what's transpiring.
Sure.
It's amazing. Yeah. And then yes, sir.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Pardon?
Sorry?
I like how he always says thank you in a very...
he's a perfect gentleman about it. And look, at first, you know, I'm like, it kind of works for me in that, like, Charlotte realizing that she's a part of some person's fetish, her knee-jerk reaction is to kind of be judgmental and to feel guilty about it. And, oh, I have to give these shoes back. I can't be a part of this. And then she, like, kind of comes around, like, for the right reasons. Who knows? But she's not, like, judging the guy.
Yeah.
By the end of it. So that's nice.
Yeah. I kind of was totally okay with that. I didn't feel like she was violated in any way that she, you know, I was it felt fair.
Oh yeah. Yeah. No,
it was a fetish exchange and, you know, and he always said what he was going to do and she agreed. And the terms were made very clear before the transaction.
Yeah. I put in my notes. This guy seems really nice.
Yeah.
I mean, sure. Buster seems, this guy seems nice. Sure. I think that one of the things that I've enjoyed watching over the course of this season is the evolution. Like, Charlotte's the one that's always shocked, right? She's always the one who sort of like is the newbie in the situation. And it's a testament to the way that they write her and the way that Kristen Davis performs her that she never feels broad or like a caricature. She never feels like she's, you know, truly absurd. Mm-hmm. But there's an enjoyment that you get out of putting Charlotte in the craziest situations that you can or the most sort of absurd situations that you can. So this was an example of that, obviously. And then on the Stanford storyline, he essentially goes to this club to sort of get over his fears of, you know, inadequacy, the way that he looks and the way that he, you know,
he's going to meet one of these online guys in person or that they'll be there.
Big tool for you, I believe. So he goes to this underwear club where they're blasting Fatboy Slim's Funk Show Brother, just to really bring you back to 1999. And he meets a nice guy and nothing comes of it, but he meets somebody nice. So
that's first of all, Stanford's supposed to be like schlubby, but like for his body type, I think he looks great. I also appreciate that his underwear is from Paris, from when he went to Paris. There's a nice Paris line through this episode. And I thought it was really cute. I don't know. I thought the money. I thought the money in the sock was really cute. Yeah. And in terms of like scandalous sort of themes, in terms of only being able to wear underwear, like this is nothing. There may be a lot more like explicit consent today, but this is, you know, I feel like pretty.
And that was one of those types of things that was the in the city part. You know, God bless. New York really used to be fun.
Right.
And, you know, it's not that anymore. And what a shame. Like that was fun.
Yeah. So the last storyline, and it's the media storyline, which I'd like to dive into, is obviously the Carrie Big storyline. Carrie goes to Big's place. He's packing to go to Paris. He tells her that there's a chance he might have to move to Paris for work for 7 months or a year. Carrie, understandably, is shocked by this information. I want to just highlight something that I really loved about this scene, which was the blocking, which is that Carrie is standing on his bed.
Yeah.
Good.
And she's barely his height standing on his bed.
Good.
And she literally like leans over and grabs his shoulder and says, "What? Sorry, what?" Like she's like just trying desperately to like wrap her head around what's going on, and it's a great visual kind of component to the scene. Of course, Big is like fucking cavalier about this information because he's an asshole. Like I'm not even talking to her about this. How he could not see that she would be upset by this is all the reasons why these two take like seven seasons to actually make it work.
It's like so gaslighty in that
just
like stirs up like, am I like the stuff that Carrie doesn't explicitly say but is so well inferred in this episode, and you kind of build it up through what they've been through before this episode, is like, am I crazy? Am I just like not? Am I like too much of a woman? Like, am I being like a crazy woman about this? And like, I should just be a cool girl and like be able to like go with it. And like, it's not even that he's mean about it. He's so nonchalant as to make you feel like you are going up like insane because he didn't even mention it.
It's a lot of that, like, why are you acting like this? What could you, why are you so upset by this?
Yeah,
it's crazy.
Yeah.
Don't be so, but I will, this isn't about you, which is such a And the but and then the next scene, she's at brunch with the girls and is so distraught and really upset, and you know, it bangs the table down. I've gotten myself back into this again, and like that felt very real to me, you know.
Totally.
I think we've all been there before, where you really have, over the course of dating, real, you know, impasses with certain people and behavioral patterns, and you keep coming back for more, and you think it's going to be different this time. And obviously that is the big thing with Big, where, you know, and like maybe he changes at the end, but still a little bit of a question mark. And that is the real, that's the heart of relationships, you know, like this person hurts me, but why do I stay? And finally you meet someone who doesn't hurt you and you end up hurting them. You know, it's like,
yeah. And there's this element of like, you have Charlotte, of course, being very Charlotte about it and being like, what's the big deal? You could just go to Paris. You have a boyfriend in Paris. Like it's not deeply impractical and speaks volumes about what's wrong with this relationship. She does then get drunk with Stanford and calls Big and has sort of this drunken conversation where she confronts him about not talking to her about the situation, which unfortunately only feeds Big's sort of preconceived notions about all of this to begin with.
I mean, she was not even that really sloppy.
I agree. It was a
cogent argument. Yes. And like 5:30 in the morning, like, you know, I don't know.
Whatever.
Right.
Yeah.
You just got there. You're on New York time still.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. She was made a pretty cogent argument, but her guilt about being sort of like hysterical and having done this thing that like she shouldn't, what it, that girlfriends don't do, right? If they want to like keep their man, like she kind of does this like about face, like I can deal with this. Like we can make this work. It's like, and sort of thankfully, like Big proves to her right off the bat that that's, you know, she's barking up the wrong tree. Because
I mean, it's so essentially what happens is she has a conversation with Charlotte and Miranda where she says, like, you know, maybe I can make this work. Maybe you're right, Charlotte. Maybe we can do long distance, blah, blah, blah. She goes to Big's house that night wearing a fucking beret and some French fries from McDonald's and some burgers from McDonald's.
One apologizing.
Yeah. Which is fucking crazy.
So typical of women.
Feels pretty relatable. Yeah. But I'm so sorry.
Like, oh, I'm sorry. I was la bitch. And it's like, oh my God. Oh,
you gave him the high ground again. Like it's unfortunate that he's demanding it essentially. Otherwise she feels as though, you know, this conversation, this relationship is going to go south. He then proceeds to tell her, she's like, maybe I could do, you know, Le Sex in the City and I could come to Paris and I could make this work. And he goes, well, I mean, if you want to do that, you should do that. But like, do that for you. Don't do that for me. Like, essentially saying, like, you know,
right?
Don't come there for me.
And she says,
don't come there expecting anything.
Like, why would I go to Paris for anyone?
Yeah.
Or for anything other than you? Which is, first of all, it's like, well, have you been to Paris? you should go. And I guess maybe speaking to what you were saying before, Phil, about how like this as like the second season, I think does not get the rewatch that others do. Like they were calling back to a lot of stuff in the final season, and really well done.
Yeah.
I was thinking the exact same thing when she shows up with the beret and the whatever, and thinking about, you know, her going to Paris with Petrovsky at the end of the series and Big chasing her to Paris. There is a very nice symmetry to that. There's also something, quite honestly, about, you know, you guys mentioned a little bit about how like perfect all the characters are, you know what I mean? In the sense of this fantasy, this New York fantasy. I think that there's a real brokenness of vulnerability and a messiness to Carrie in this season in particular, that she starts to, you know, she certainly gets her, quote unquote, gets her shit together as things progress. But seeing her in his kitchen, she throws the burgers against his TV. You've got like fucking Big Mac sauce everywhere.
Yeah.
And she's like holding on to sort of the island in his kitchen, just being like, how did I get here again? Like, how did I allow myself to do this again? It's unbelievably human. And I talked about this with Emily Nussbaum, but like there's an anti-hero quality to Carrie Bradshaw. Mm-hmm. You know, the rom-com anti-hero of a person who is a little bit selfish, a little bit broken, isn't always the best friend to other people. And I think all of that makes her a real human being. And that's why I love her as a character. And I'm sort of curious what you guys think about how all of that feeds into it.
Oh, absolutely. Like her relationship stuff and like the sort of men that she finds herself drawn to, you know, in terms of the ones that really kind of like hold on over the course of the series, I think that feels incredibly relatable. And it's like, yeah, you can be really sort of broken and messy and complicated and super, super aspirational, like when you're a child like that and when you have abs like that. You're like, yeah, I'm just like Carrie because I'm so messy. And
she does love to show that midriff when she can. I mean, who wouldn't under the circumstances?
Yeah, I would be fasting that all day.
Please.
One thing I was thinking a lot about as I was watching this episode and the episodes leading up to it was, you know, one thing that they don't really ever elaborate much on, with the exception of with Samantha, is their age. Mm-hmm. Yes. And, you know, I think in like a couple episodes before this, Miranda mentions that she's 33. Mm-hmm. But I think that does, now that I am, you know, now that today I am the age, you know, a little older, but, you know, it lasted. That they would be then, and having grown up with the show and kind of grown up sexually and romantically with the show as a reference, it is interesting now to rewatch this stuff and think like, yeah, Carrie at this point is in her early to mid 30s. Mm-hmm. She is in love with a very successful guy, and he lives a life that she probably wants to have. And he has kind of made it seem like she's there, that they are there. And it does feel like a lot is kind of riding on this, and she has put everything into it. And, you know, just the heartbreak to that. And Haley, like you say, like, sure, of course you can be aspirational despite your quote unquote brokenness. Mm-hmm. But I think that is what we all do with relationships, certainly serious ones. You know, there has to be an element of aspiration, whether that is, you know, you aspire to have a really like a sweeping romance, and, or like with Samantha, just like really great sexual chemistry, or like Charlotte, you know, like the social implication and you know, financial implication of your relationship. I mean, I think all of the women sort of hit so many different parts of what all kind of goes through a woman's mind while they're dating, and I presume a male's mind. But, you know, Carrie's neuroses come out so much in this episode that, and you really want to unpack so much of that. You know, you really, God, to, and this is, I think this is why I loved the Carrie Diaries, because you want to know, where the fuck does Carrie come from? What was her relationship with her father like? My God.
Well, yeah. Unpack
so much. And, you know, I feel like we could all learn a lot from, you know, her unpacking that for us. But I think that's sort of on us. We are left then, you know, we watch this relationship unfold and, you know, devolve and re-evolve constantly. And you hate to see it happen, but then you love to see it happen. Yeah. And then you apply it to your own life, and really, it, you know, and that, again, to take it back to why I find the show so brilliant, is that it all does feel so applicable. Mm-hmm. What is it, you know, okay, I don't know why Carrie made this decision, because I don't know what her father fucking did to her, when she was younger, but I know the answers to that in my own life. And, you know, I'm going to sit here and maybe unload it for a little bit.
Well, I think there's two things that really struck me too about the Carrie Big dynamic is, and that I thought were really smart. And again, you know, first show that lacks subtlety sometimes when it comes to some of the smaller details of like big emotional ideas. Like, I think they do a really good job, whether intentionally or not. Like, when she calls Big drunk, like one of the last things she says is like, you know, I have a job too, right? And there is this thing where like, and I think it's true, and I think it, to a degree it's still true, that like for men and especially like straight hetero cisgender men, like, you know, you derive so much of your identity from your work, or at least you're told that, right? Mm-hmm. And I think for women, we're told that we derive so much of our identity, or have been told we derive so much of our identity from our relationship status, right? And so there's like this really great knocking of heads where it's like, just because I think about our relationship all the time doesn't mean I don't have a life. Like, doesn't mean it's something that I'm weighing in addition to all of the other things that I weigh in my life, whether it's professional or my friends or my family or whatever. And I thought that was, I don't know, that just rang really true to me. That just felt very, very valid.
Yeah. To piggyback on that for a second, you know, that's one of the things that comes to a head in the kitchen, mm-hmm. which is that Big literally says like, this is about my work.
Right.
This isn't about, and she's like, but I don't understand why that's mutually exclusive. Like, why can't those two things speak to each other? You know, and I will say, as someone who, you know, in my last relationship, I got into a big argument with the person I was seeing at the time, because she thought that I was choosing to stay in a writer's room until 11 o'clock at night. And I'm like, not choosing to. This is my job. And it's unfortunate that it is what it is. That's not what Big is doing here. What Big is doing here is excluding her, removing her from sort of creating two islands and feeling as though that's okay. And it's not. And, you know, you even see it in that scene where she's like, I will bring my work to Paris so that I can do my job and be with you. And to him, his response to that being, of course, like, well, I mean, don't do it for me.
Well, unreasonable. I care about you and your job. If that's what you want.
And the blocking also of that episode, I know you brought up the first one where she's like standing on the bed and like, but here literally there is a physical kitchen island between them. And I think what she says, you know, when she says, you know, whatever you think, we are close. We have gotten closer.
Yeah.
And you're so afraid of it, you need to put an ocean between us.
Yeah.
Watching that scene in preparation for then talking about the series, you know, it's really, I was like, I wonder how we're going to talk about this, because it's so hard to talk about Sex and the City without unpacking your own shit. And that, I think that scene and the things that can come up in that scene are, you know, for all of the things that Sex and the City can really trivialize, mm-hmm. that actually detrivializes a lot of it and really calls people out on their shit. Mm-hmm. And it was really hard to watch, you know, when he says, you know, I'm going for work. It's not, this isn't about us. It's about work. I watched the episode twice, and at the same time, I'm like, ugh.
Oh, fuck you.
Fuck you.
I literally go like, it's not about work. It's about you. It's about you, Big.
It's also, and then on top of all of it, you know, the real end of this storyline is mm-hmm. he shows up at her apartment. You know, Carrie does her classic, I'm sure she said this VO more times than I can remember, of we were out of things to say and they just had to have sex.
Right.
So, you know, they have sex. She wakes up. She's sitting in a chair by the window smoking. he's laying in her bed, and she basically just says, like, go to fucking Paris. Like, I'm done. Like, this mm-hmm. is, the, you know, I can't be what yeah. you want me to be. And there is a part of me that never felt like Big was ever fully invested in this thing. I mean, you have an episode earlier in the season where, you know, he shows up at a drinks with the, it's the one where Miranda runs out into the rain to catch Steve, and Big shows up, and it's like the big, like, romance can work. And then by the end of the season, you're just like, romance is dead. None of this is working. No one. So, like, I appreciate that the episode ends with her basically saying, like, I have to save myself. Like, this isn't working.
Mm-hmm. Right. She was to the chair.
Oh, she let, yeah, in her VO, she says, tied to a chair, untying herself from Big. It's whatever. Yeah. It's, you know, it's one of those episodes that I honestly think, talking about this with you, both of you, you know, watching it, I was like, this episode's like, the Big Carrie stuff is good. Mm-hmm. The other stuff feels pretty disposable. Mm-hmm. But now talking about the Big Carrie stuff, it's one of the better episodes of the season when it comes to their storyline.
Yeah,
it's also, I mean, like, important, right? It ends up being important. It ends up being important in, like, the rest of the show. You know,
It's, I mean, it's important because, you know, spoiler for those who haven't seen the show, you know, Big goes to Paris. Big meets, what the hell is her name? I can't remember his. Natasha, of course. Sounds like a villain. Natasha, who he, you know, ultimately marries and blah, blah, blah. But yeah, I mean, it's a great season finale. Yeah. This tees all that up. You get to have Carrie paired off with a couple guys, John Bon Jovi being one of them in the next episode. Mm-hmm. And
I see your Natasha. I raise you, John Bon Jovi. Fucker.
A baby-faced John Bon Jovi, may
yeah.
I add.
Yeah, wow. Yeah. But it's yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, this show is spinning a lot of plates. And as someone, obviously, who's been in writers' rooms, the tonal shifts that this show tries to achieve within, you know, 22, 25, 28 minutes or whatever it is each week is incredibly impressive. And people, again, don't give the show enough credit for being able to, within the span of this episode, have, you know, Charlotte with a foot fetishist and, you know, Miranda getting railed by Will Arnett, and then somehow mixing that into this Carrie Big stuff, and it all pretty much works. It might not be the best episode of Sex and the City, but I still think it does work quite well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No.
This, I, our Patreon viewers are going to love the perspective that we're getting of Alexandra Amin's apartment. Being carried like a toddler through her apartment.
It's about to die.
Just to wrap up, I'm sorry?
It's like podcast cribs.
Podcast cribs.
My version of Carrie Bradshaw's apartment, you know, I'm a, you know, whatever.
Yeah. So I have two questions for you guys as we wrap up the episode. One of them I'm going to spring on you because it just kind of occurred to me, and I'm curious as to the answer. The second one I told you at the top of the show. The first question is: do you have a favorite episode? Or a thing that sort of doesn't need to be an episode. Maybe it's an arc. Maybe it's sort of, you know, a thing that happened on the show. But, like, is there something on a sort of grander level that you really love about the show?
You know,
I'll tell you mine. How about I tell you mine and I can help maybe you guys?
Yeah, tell me. Yeah. Okay. The thing that really I was going to say is that every time I go back and rewatch Sex and the City, I'm like, God, that episode was really good too. Yeah. You know, it's like you forget and then you go back and you're like, oh God, I remember that episode. That was so good.
It's really fun to be along for the ride. Yeah.
Yes. My favorite episode is in season 4. My motherboard, myself. It's the episode where Miranda's mother dies, written by Rotenberg and Zaritsky, who, fingers crossed, maybe we'll have on this podcast. Yeah, I mean, season four is my favorite season of the show. It feels like it's the show at the peak of its powers, the show when it's it's just absolutely nailing what it wants to be doing. You get Miranda having Steve's baby. You have like you have you know, Samantha in a real relationship. You've got the second iteration of Trey. It's all just good stuff. Mm-hmm. But that particular episode for me is a perfect example of the tonal stuff that I was talking about, where you have Miranda's mother dying, but you also have Samantha having lost her orgasm and is unsure of, like, it's part of, you know, obviously her fear of mortality, her fear of all the various things that are going on in the world. And then on top of it, you have Carrie's computer crashing and Aiden not knowing how to reboot it because he's a PC person and she's a Mac person. And he works with wood. But like Carrie taking her computer to the Mac store and him saying you're not compatible between her and Aiden. It's just really great stuff. I just love all of that. But do you guys have something that you really love?
That is a great episode. And is that the one that Carrie and Miranda have like a moment? Or is it Samantha and Miranda? They like have an emotional.
Yes. Samantha cries that she releases and cries and says, I'm sorry, because she had never been able to tell Miranda that sooner in the episode.
Yeah.
That was, and Miranda crying single as she walks up the aisle and then Carrie. Yeah. It's, and then the guys show up. Like, it's just, it's a perfect episode of the show, I think.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
You know, there, I don't know if, I wish I could get back to you on that.
It's fine. Yeah, don't worry.
But there are, of course, you know, defining scenes that I have taken with me and I reference from the time. But there is an episode where Carrie buys the apartment next door or something.
And Aiden redoes her floors.
He's trying to blast through the wall. He's trying to bring the two apartments together.
Yeah. And she kind of like, they partition off with a curtain her side, the bedroom area. And they, you know, I just remember her saying, you know, I need my space. Like, just give me my space. And by the end of the episode, he kind of just like gives her her space. And then she takes the step forward and is like, what you doing out there? You know, like pokes her head.
He puts a little curtain so that she has, and then she, when having the space, doesn't want the space anymore, which is.
Mm-hmm. And the, you know, the ups and downs of, you know, I think that the Carrie Aiden relationship over the course of the series, you know, I think was one of those mature relationships that, you know, you see play out in your own life and with many different, you know, in little things that happen here and there. But I do remember from time to time, you know, over the course of dating certain people, thinking back to that scene of just like, God, if they would just give me my space, I would step forward and be like, close that gap.
Yeah. What about you, Haley? Did you have something?
No, I just want you to push me away just a little. Hello.
Do you have something, Haley?
Oh man, favorite episode. I feel like the thing that sticks out in my brain, because I haven't rewatched the whole series in some time.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. I do think that there is some really fun Miranda stuff when she gets pregnant. Like a couple of moments that just stick out to me, one on the very comedic side with Miranda and then one on a really heartbreaking side is one is when they go to Atlantic City, like to get their groove back.
Mm-hmm.
And Miranda can finally like fit into jeans that whatever. And like some asshole, asshole calls her fat. And I just remember like Miranda like remembers like, yeah, wait, I did just have a baby. Someone's like, fuck you, she just had a baby. And then someone's like, what's your excuse? Triplets? I'll never forget that. That was good
Samantha
stuff.
Jones.
Yeah.
God.
And then on the emotional end, I think this must have been towards the finale, but the scene where Steve's mom, who has Alzheimer's, gets lost and Miranda ends up giving her a sponge bath. Like, it's just, it's not necessarily the thing that epitomizes the show. And it is like towards the end of the show. And I don't want to like, I don't want to denigrate or play down how much I love like the fun and early Sex and the City stuff. But like, that's just something I will never, like, it's just something that I totally, like, it's such a strong memory.
I want to highlight. Sorry. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
You know, because I also went back and listened to the episode that you recorded with Amy Harris, and you know, just her talking about how most of the writers' room remained the same, and you realize like they were writing that show for like 7 years, and that they grew up so much, and that you see that evolution in, you know, just. Think back to that first season where things were, you're like, oh God, this is not watchable really. Cause none of it, it's cartoonish.
Yes.
And then, you know, to think that you end on a note like Haley, that scene you referenced with Steve's mother and the, you know, I mean, I remember crying when I watched that.
Oh yeah.
And you know, this is like, it really, the show really evolved and it was such a, you know, a mirror into our own individual evolution.
I also, you know, I want to highlight one other thing because I think it's worth talking about, which is, you know, the show is about taboos. The show is about sort of, you know, dealing with prickly issues from time to time. And they have a tremendous episode that deals with abortion where, you know, Miranda gets pregnant. They have a really funny scene. It's one of my favorite scenes, which is they go to this pizza place. It's just Miranda and Carrie. And Miranda asks Carrie if she's ever had an abortion. And she says, I had one. And she explains the situation. And she says that she met this guy at the saloon or something, like some like shitty TGIF Fridays place or something like that. Mm-hmm. And Miranda, I mean, Cynthia Nixon's delivery is just is so pitch perfect on so many levels throughout the whole show. But the way she says no judgment. Is fantastic. Yeah. And then Carrie's like, well, maybe you should have it. And she's like, you know what? You're right. I'm having Steve's baby. Pizza for everybody. It's just like the way that they're able to deal with thorny issues in ways very adroitly, very funny, but heartfelt and smart. Again, I don't mean to beat a dead horse, but like this is the stuff that this show, I feel like, doesn't get the credit that it deserves. It feels like a show that people think is just a jewel encrusted whatever. Mm-hmm. And I just don't think that that's a fair, you know, fair reading of the show. But all that being said, go ahead.
Oh, I was gonna say, I think it did get, you know, it got so much sort of props in its time that I think there is like this internalized kind of like reboundy backlashy thing, and the stuff that you hold on to is the stuff that also kind of got bigger and in some ways better, but like way over the top by the end, which was like, which was the fashion and the visuals and the like, you know, aspirational part of it.
It started to drink its own Kool-Aid a little bit.
Sure.
Which is understandable. But so my last question to you guys, I asked this before we got on mic, but do you have a favorite character? Do you have a character that, you know, that speaks to you? You know, it doesn't need to be your you know, spirit animal, but, you know, something that,
You know, and I think most people would always say, like, you know, to all four combined, they are the perfect
character. Sure, sure, sure.
My favorite character is the city, which would be the heard of it, New York City.
Yeah. I just, you know, I personally don't think the show is as digestible and as fun as Sex in the City should be fun without Samantha. And I go back and you watch Kim Cattrall and you're like, God damn, she was doing it. She showed up every week and put on a fucking show. And
she really did.
I just, you know, give her a Lifetime Achievement Award for that. You know, she just, I just love that character so much, even though she is probably the least relatable for most of the show, because there are tidbits here and there where like the real Samantha comes out. And I think the stuff that, you know, the friendship between Carrie and Samantha is the most, I think the most developed and really in depth, and you really see, you know, but she's so absurd and ridiculous that when those moments of actual relatable humanity happen, or she's heartbroken or she's hurt, you know, you really feel that. Because there's so much distinction between those two parts to her, but I
would also, I also think it's worth saying too, and this is not to take anything away from Kristen Davis or Cynthia Nixon, because I adore Charlotte and Miranda, but there's an iconography, there's an iconic component to Carrie and Samantha that really sort of, and part of that has to do with the fact that they seem larger than life. They seem sort of like some next level thing, but that elevation is what you're talking about. I think where like Kim Cattrall is taking a character that in the wrong hands would have played as goofy or clownish or over the top. And she gives it three dimensions in a way that, you know, I agree. She's fantastic. Yeah.
I mean, the idea that her character, against all odds, really does not go into the realm of caricature. Like,
totally.
Yeah.
It's insane. And there are just so many like wonderful moments. I'm reminded of the Pearl thong where she had to take the stairs. I mean, that is
her face is unbelievable.
Incredible. And she's so consistent and she's so confident in her performance.
We needed Kim Cattrall in 50 Shades of Grey, you know?
Yeah. But instead we got a different Kim. You got a Kim Basinger in that So, you know.
You know, it's like they really missed so many marks, but that was something they could have.
So Haley, do you have a character that jumps out at you?
I wholeheartedly agree with sure. Alex about Samantha. I guess, and not only because I played her in a sorority rush sketch, but I am a bit of a Miranda. Believe it or not. But also, you know, Cynthia Nixon's such a talented actress, and and the way that character developed over the course of the show.
Totally. Yeah. Totally.
And obviously there were huge seismic like life things that happened. Mm-hmm. But I mean, in terms of the way she approaches relationships, like I find Carrie the most relatable, and I think that's by design. I think there's just so much like sure. There's so much fun, neurotic gray area with her that I think is just inherently like relatable. But I do just have so much affection for Miranda. She was done so dirty in some of the early episodes in terms of some of the fashion choices and the hair, and like, we get it. She's serious, you know, like what? Like,
but even when she's not serious, I feel like her clothes are like, I mean, I sent you guys a screenshot, texted it to you, and I was just like, what's Miranda wearing? Like, what are you doing? Like, I feel like she's wearing something neon in like half the episode.
Still not the worst thing she wears in this episode. The skirt that she wears on the date with Will Arnett, I'm like, I literally did a deep dive on Cynthia Nixon to find out when she was pregnant with her first child. Because I was like, are they trying to hide something? Because they're not doing a very good job. Yeah. Like, what is going on here? She was not pregnant. It was just a bad seeing her, like, that was one way that as the show got even more and more glamorous, like, she benefited like the most in a way. And that was really fun to see.
Well, I think that, you know, there's an episode in season two where it's when her and Steve are on the rocks, sort of in the middle of the season. And it's about her just not taking him seriously. He's a bartender. Yeah. She doesn't feel like it's a real thing, but he really likes her. And obviously as the series progresses, they obviously end up together. But, the struggle she has, unlike the other three women, it seems, of finding independence and finding love and making sure that she's not sort of siloing herself off from people, and that slow but surely progress of being able to be herself and be with someone who loves her for who she is, I mean, is what we all strive for. And they do a really beautiful job of delineating that through her character.
Yeah. And she like went through some legitimately painful shit on like the friendship side of things when she became a mom, you know, is a part of my social world, just like over.
And she is also she's really the only one who we track in terms of a career and like career achievements, you know. Carrie, obviously her job is a fake job, you know, I mean, it's not so much fake in that it doesn't exist, but it's not like, you know, it's not a real,
it's not paying for those shoes in that apartment. Right. That's for sure.
And the men she dates never reference the column that she writes about them in.
Right.
It doesn't come up.
And only with
Petrovsky. Yeah.
Right. And you know, and Samantha and Chris and Charlotte they have these sort of like, I'm a rich girl jobs, you know, with like being a publicist, a very successful publicist, and, you know, and then being a gallerist that, you know, when a successful gallerist, when you're 30, you know, it's like, okay, so we have to assume that these women are rich, and you know, their careers, their professions don't really matter. You know, but Miranda, you know, as you're watching it as a working woman, Miranda really is the only person who you can actually relate to on that level of, you know, on the career level, which is the majority of what you spend your life doing when you're a young woman. You know, there's that episode in this season where she, you know, after Steve, you know, and after she and Steve break up, and she goes out to dinner with, you know, a partner in her company that had just gotten
with the hair plugs.
Oh yeah.
Like, you know, I know it's super personal, but like what, you know, what's going on personal in your life? And she's like, oh, I don't know. Do you really want to know? And then it leads to discussion about freezing of eggs. And this asshole.
Oh my God.
He did not know the future, because if he was buy your stock now in like, you know, dry ice.
Egg freezing.
Look out, world.
Self-righteousness of that guy. But the thing I love about Miranda is that they put her into situations like that, and she's always got the right comeback. You know, where it's like, I wish I had Miranda with me so many times when things like that has happened, because she always has such a killer comeback that really puts people in their shoes.
Yeah. I don't need to be lectured by a man who's a crop rotating his forehead, I think is what she said.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. God.
But I will also say too on the Miranda side, you know, and this is a testament to the show. She's the last one you expect to see pregnant. She's the last one you expect to go through motherhood first. I mean, Charlotte's the one that obviously wants it much more. Which again, like not giving the thing to the person that wants the thing, and then giving the thing. Like it's just finding the complexities, finding the messiness, making sure that you're always finding good story that explores and shows sides of these characters in just really smart ways. You know, I love the show. And I'm so thankful that you guys came on to talk about it with me.
Thanks for having us.
Always happy to talk about Sex in the City.
Mm-hmm. You're both going to come back for something else.
I'm going to keep watching. It's been a nice, like, it's been comforting.
It has been.
It's a perfect pandemic watch. That is for sure. That, and so was Felicity, quite frankly. That was a really nice, comforting watch too. It definitely took me out of what was going on at the time. But thank you both for what was that?
Never seen an episode of Felicity.
You would love Felicity. I really do think you would.
I don't think they would love it. Haley would get it and would like it, but I don't think she would love it. I think that there is a little too much emo-ness to it, and I think Haley's a little bit more resilient. I think she'd be a little bit more like, "Oh, shut up."
Wait, here's what let me rephrase what I'm saying. Love it is a strong word. Here's what I think. I think you would enjoy the pilot, directed by Matt Reeves, written and directed by Matt Reeves and JJ. And I think you would see a lot more things in it today. I mean, part of what I loved about doing this rewatch, not to sit here and, you know, talk about Felicity, but just very quickly, I'll just say this. I watched it right around the time that Normal People was dropping. Mm. And to see a lot of Felicity in Normal People, to see a lot of those pregnant pauses, to see a lot of that just, you know, talking very earnestly about your emotions. There's a lot of Felicity in a lot of premium streaming and cable content, which is, I think, why it stood the test of time a little bit better. But I would just say that the pilot's very good and the pilot's worth rewatching, and that's all I'll say about that. But I very much appreciate you both coming on. And I'm obviously, you guys are going to come back for something else. There's many other shows for us to talk about and other movies to talk about. But thank you for coming on, guys. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Phil.
One last thing, please rate, review, and subscribe. Speaking of subscribing, check out our Patreon on all the best films of 1989, Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Fabulous Baker Boys, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, Field of Dreams, Major League, and many, many more. We are covering all the best films of 1989 with amazing guests like Joanna Robinson, Liz Hanna, Hunter Covington, Brian Cogman, David Iserson, and many, many more. All your favorite guests from our 1999 podcast are coming on to the 1989 Patreon. You can sign up for it at patreon.com/podcastlikeit's1989. For only $5, you get access to all of these awesome episodes. And for a few bucks more, you get video of our 1999 episodes as well. Plus, there are other very cool tiers too, where you can even be a guest on our podcast. Also, please check out our Reddit as well at reddit.com/podcastlikeits. We're also on Twitter at podcastlikeits. We're also on Instagram at podcastlikeits. Thank you to Ernie and Will for producing our episode, Sullivan for our social media, Jan Katas for our artwork and theme songs, and most of all, thank you all for listening. Podcast like it's 1999. Podcast like it's. You want a podcast like it's 1999.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.